On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Supreme Court has spoken. Bong hits for Jesus is out as protected speech. So much for the high school kids in Alaska and their cheeky banner. Big money campaign ads, however, are back in. By a 5-4 vote, the High Court said big corporations, unions, anybody with a bundle of cash can, in the waning hours of a political campaign, push into the fray with big money issue ads. Chief Justice John Roberts says, free speech. Critics say the vote is once again losing to the power of the almighty dollar. Up next on Point, money talks, cash and power now in American democracy. Joining me first today for a read on yesterday's Supreme Court decision is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate.com. Dahlia, it seems like you're everywhere. We're delighted to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So what do you read in this vote yesterday? Who came down where, and what's it mean for how the court stands on speech and campaign money?
You know, this was another very, very interesting 5-4 decision. I think that, you know, the first sort of overarching point is we live in a 5-4 America now. You know, the court handed down five decisions yesterday, of which four were the same 5-4 margin.
And a different 5-4 America from just a couple of years ago.
Well, you know, it was never quite a 5-4 America. It was always a 4-4-1 America.
Okay.
You know, there was always that one funny vote in play, whether it was Sandra Day O'Connor or Anthony Kennedy. I think there are no votes in play anymore. And it's very interesting, because what you're seeing as a consequence is this new 5-4 Roberts Court that's kind of going through and systematically dismantling old cases. And so one of the most notable things about the campaign finance case was that the court only just 4 years ago ruled on this exact same issue and came out differently. So one of the most dramatic things, just as a big theme in looking at this, is that this really signals that the difference between the composition of the court is the difference in the law in this country. I just don't think that question is in dispute.
With a 5-vote conservative majority now at work, what did the court say in 2003, and what did they say yesterday, Dahlia?
Well, this is not a challenge to the entire Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. That was the 2002 campaign reform measure that's in question. It was a provision that was a ban on using so-called soft money.
Mm-hmm.
Unions and corporations couldn't spend soft money on what we call, or at least the objectors call, sham issue ads. And everybody knows what those are. Those are the ads that say, Russ Feingold is really bad, and he filibusters all the time, and, you know, he's...
Send a message to Russ Feingold.
Pick up your phone right now and call Russ Feingold and let him know what you think. Now, what the court says is, look, that's not direct advocacy. We're not advocating for his opponent. We are making a point about an issue. You know, in this particular case, it was a Wisconsin group called Wisconsin Right to Life.
Right.
And they said, we want to run these ads in the so-called blackout period before the election. It's 30 days before a primary, 60 days before a general election, that these kinds of ads were blacked out. And what you had was a provision that said, unions and corporations, you can't funnel money to these kinds of issue ads, because they really are, and everybody who watches them knows that they are advocacy ads, particularly in this particular case where the commercial in question said, so pick up your phone and call Russ Feingold, or go to our website and, you know, see that we're in fact advocating for the other guy.
Right. Jimmied up at the last minute to go after a candidate with major corporate money that had been opposed to exactly some of the McCain-Feingold kind of restrictions on the spending.
That's right. This is that sort of unregulated soft money that, as we know, just keeps seeping back into the system. No matter where you try to sort of dam the flow, it keeps coming back in. Now, 4 years ago, the Supreme Court looked at this exact provision and said, and you're trying to make this hard determination about when is an ad an issue ad, when is it advocacy, and the court said, look, you know, we are going to call these issue ads, these kind of sham issue ads, if there's an ad that says, you know, Jane Doe is really, really bad, don't, you know, pick up the phone and call her and let her know what you think. We're going to say that can be banned in this blackout period. But that was Justice O'Connor on the court. And so what we saw yesterday was a new court, Justice Alito in place of O'Connor, and the court said, well, we're not exactly overruling McConnell, that case from 4 years ago.
Right.
We're just saying this ad, as it's applied, narrowly as it's applied to Wisconsin Right to Life, is unconstitutional speech. And in probably the most quoted sentence in the case.
I think they said, didn't they say the ad was protected speech, not unconstitutional, but constitutionally
right.
protected
right.
on its merits?
Right, that this is constitutional. The Chief Justice described it as core political speech. And
mm-hmm.
he essentially said, I'm not going to go down the road of separating, you know, real advocacy ads from issue ads. I'm going to say if an ad doesn't directly advocate for a candidate, it's okay.
And Samuel Alito lined up with him, as did Antonin Scalia, Anthony Kennedy, and Clarence Thomas. What did the dissenters say here?
Well, the dissenters said, for one thing, if you're going to go around overruling four-year-old cases, overrule them. You know, you can't say we're not overruling it.
But effectively doing it,
and that's sort of become a trend. But Justice David Souter, writing in dissent, really gave a long, long history of how, you know, this kind of unregulated soft money from big, big, big donors has infected the legal system, the electoral system. It's done it for years. He described, you know, 100 years of efforts to try to curb these kinds of undue influence by big money. And he said, in effect, you know, this is contributing to massive public cynicism about the fairness of elections. And he cites all sorts of data and says, you know, the Congress went and tried to kind of create a narrow ban, and you've eviscerated, as he said, you've stood it on its head, you've made it basically meaningless, and how can Congress even go back and fix it? So in effect, what he's saying is, you know, this is decades of public cynicism, decades of built-up frustration about the effect of big money on our system, and you've obliterated any attempt to fix it.
But that is the voice of the now 4-vote Supreme Court minority, and in the 5-4 world you describe, the more conservative view of Chief Justice Roberts taking the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's as I said, you know, two big themes that really do take the day. One is that you have this tendency to sort of hollow out very recent precedent without expressly overruling it, and I think that creates real ambiguity for courts later trying to figure out exactly what happened. And again, you know, this willingness to say that even though, you know, the world as constructed by Sandra Day O'Connor, you know, the clear lines or clear-ish lines that were constructed between what is advocacy ads and what is issue ads is now no longer a clear line at all.
Dahlia, it's wonderful to have you. Thanks very much for filling us in.
It's always a pleasure, Tom.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal affairs writer for Slate.com. She spoke with us there from Charlottesville, Virginia. We are talking today about big money politics and American power. Joining me right now from Washington is Sheila Krumholz, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics. They pay a lot of attention to these issues. Sheila, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you with us today.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Sheila, first to you on the court's most recent ruling. Put it in context for us. Where does this sit in the whole landscape of big money politics in this country right now?
Well, what this means is that we can definitely expect to see more broadcast advertising in general in the days leading up to the elections, and that they can be paid for through the sponsor's treasury rather than their PAC. And
that means from the soft money realm that's less controlled and more open to big contributions.
Right. Coming directly from the corporate treasury or labor
mm-hmm.
union treasury.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And with that, I mean, do you see a wide open signal here? What about the Chief Justice saying, look, when it comes right down to it, free speech has to trump these other concerns? Is he wrong on that?
Well, there's always been a healthy tension between free speech and protecting politics and the creation of policy from corruption. And it's a real concern. It's going to be with us for a long time. This is how they came down on it. But I think this is not the end of the fight by any means.
Do you see this, though, as a defeat for anti-big money politics?
You know, I'm not an election lawyer. I'm not even a legal analyst. But I do think that it's a huge disappointment for those who had hoped that the court would keep up with the precedent that had been set just a few years ago. So this is perhaps the first chink in the armor of the BCRA ruling.
Jack Beattie, A New World, Dahlia Lithwick says, a five-vote majority that's conservative and ready to act on it, kind of here, but act on it enough to change the lay of the land.
A new world, but also a very old story in American politics. And as Dahlia says, Justice Souter in his dissent gives a capsule history of that. And the story of trying to keep big money out of politics begins in the 1880s. Politicians had financed their campaigns by assessments on government employees. Herman Melville, an inspector of the docks on the Hudson River, had to give a 2% of his salary to the Republican Party. The Pendleton Act, establishing the civil service, ended that. And so then corporations had to find a new way, and the new way was just to give directly from their treasuries to parties. This culminated in 1896 with the Republicans raising $16 million against the Democrats' William Jennings Bryan's $600,000. The reaction to that was strong, even within the Republican Party, where impulse for reform led in 1907, 100 years ago, to a law banning corporate contributions directly to political campaigns.
We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court's new 5-4 decision on campaign ads and the power of big money politics in America. Sheila Krumholz is with us. She's executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, tracking the role of money in many paths and guises in Washington. On Point News analyst Jack Beattie is with us. And joining us as well right now from Berlin in Germany, as it happens, is Lawrence Lessig. He's a professor of law at Stanford Law School, author of Free Culture, founder of Stanford University's Center for Internet and Society, who has recently turned his focus to the realm of money and politics. Lawrence Lessig, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're watching from abroad this time as America takes another step via the Supreme Court decision on money's capacity to go to work in politics. You've recently sort of thrown over your whole apple cart and made this your number one issue, your number one focus. Why?
Well, I think that people are seeing that in many contexts of American government, whether it's global warming or the issues I was working on around regulation of intellectual property, there's a fundamental skewing of American politics that's being caused by money. And that's because politicians, they're not evil, or they're not being bribed in a traditional way, but politicians might spend so much of their time focusing on the single question of how they raise money to get reelected. And that means they can't help but skew the way they think about issues according to how money directs it, as opposed to according to what good policy is. So it struck me that until we solve this problem, there were so many other problems that just were not going to get solved. And these were not small issues about pork barrel bridges or tunnels that might get built in certain parts of the country. These were huge issues affecting, in the case of global warming, the future of the planet.
Sheila, you're there in Washington. You watch closely. Do you see evidence that nobody can dispute of money trumping proper policy, or is it always murky?
Well, it's never as clear as money delivered and a vote bought. I mean, that is, there have been cases of bribery and people have gone to jail. But typically, it is more often the case that money buys access, and then the client, the corporate interest or the special interest, employs that opportunity by hiring a crew of K Street lobbyists and pushing their agenda in Congress. And of course, there is a mutually beneficial system here at work where they need to have their needs met legislatively, and the member of Congress or the candidate needs to get their reelection funded. And so it is a kind of sick symbiotic relationship that does ultimately have a corrupting influence on policy and politics.
Jack, I have to say, I've heard more politicians speak more publicly about this recently, saying kind of, help me, send me money or give me a powerful argument, because I need help from the citizens, or else I'm going to have to do what money interests want, because I need money to get reelected and stay here as your representative.
Yes, they're a little like St. Augustine in the brothel. Save me, O Lord, but not yet. and why? Because they spend the almost the whole of their non-camera time raising money. It's estimated that if this is, in fact, going to be the first $1 billion presidential campaign, a campaign in which the two candidates between them will spend $1 billion, that will mean that for 2 years, on average, the candidates will have had to have raised $680,000 a day.
That's busy.
That's busy. And so their whole activity goes into this. And secondly, for the part, you know, it puts them at variance with their voters. I think it does it with Republican voters in some cases, but even more and more with Democratic voters. The Democrats claim to be the party of the people, of regular working people. And yet their funders are not regular working people. And again and again and again, the voice of the funders is heard over the voice of the people. And that's the substantial state interest that is that should be set against the freedom of speech issues here. The government interest in the integrity of the democratic process and in the idea of political equality. One man, one person, one vote, and each person sort of being heard at the same level. Money drowns that out.
I want to hear from our listeners particularly on this issue. Let's go to Robert calling from Boston. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't think we live in a purely representative democracy, and I don't think that's what the Constitution ingrains in our political culture. I think we have a long history of landed people with money being able to have a little bit better say in the political course of our country, and for good reason. Sometimes they have a better idea of how to steer our country towards a brighter economic future.
So you say you welcome the sort of thumb on the scales that gives a bigger voice or some advantage to moneyed voices. What, you're more confident they're going to push for policy that's ultimately good for the country?
Well, ultimately good for themselves and their own business interests. But I think as a pure trickle-down economics theory, it does come to me and the rest of us.
Let's go to Lawrence Lessig with that. Professor Lessig, you've watched a lot of money interests in Silicon Valley and elsewhere go to work in the Democratic arena. Our caller Robert says, hey, landed interests have always had a bigger voice, and maybe that's not a bad thing.
Well, I don't agree with Robert in the general case, even if you can pick particular cases where you might think it's plausible. In general, it's not. In general, what money does is cloud policymakers from judgments that really have nothing to do with good, that have nothing to do in the end with good policy. The point is it's a kind of corruption. I mean, imagine Exxon went to a federal judge who was deciding a case that affected Exxon and said, we'll build a brand new office building for you. We'd all understand that to be a kind of corruption. So why would Exxon goes to a congressman who's going to be voting on issues affecting Exxon and says, you know, we're going to give you $50,000 for your campaign, we don't understand the same thing to be a similar kind of corruption. Now, in both cases, you could say, well, you know, Exxon's got a lot of jobs on the line, and they're doing a lot for the economy, so why not let them influence the process in just that way? But I think the answer is, we want policymakers to be thinking about good policy, not about what happens if I decide this, will it help me raise more money for my office building or for my campaign or maybe even my back pocket.
Sheila, what do you read in the culture in Washington these days? Do you hear senators and representatives or feel them thinking, well, you know what, maybe this isn't so bad. It's people with money who have got it figured out anyway. You know, the unwashed masses are just manipulated and ignorant. And so it's not such a crisis if money speaks loudly here.
You know, I don't think that is their position generally. We hear from a lot of players, either politicians or influence makers, trying to, what they say is, we hate this system. This is the system that we have learned to successfully play by. And of course, they're not then that eager to change it because they've mastered it. But they hate the money chase. They understand, they know and hate the fact that they can't spend time reading legislation. They are,
because they're out raising
not
dollars,
even reading the bill, right? Because it's a constant money chase. It's never ending, and it's all consuming. So I don't think it's the members or candidates would say this is the best system we could produce. And I also think that Nobody likes the fact, or few like the fact, although perhaps with the exception of Robert, that the bulk of the money comes from this tiny fraction of Americans. I mean, how can they be the ones to best husband the policy and direction of the country?
Mm. Sheila, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go to Cedar Falls, Iowa, and Varun. Varun, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah. You know, back to the politics of the Supreme Court decision, it's just an example of how influential the Bush administration is. I mean, this Supreme Court is not bipartisan, it's biased. I mean, going back to the decision with the taxpayers saying no to the religious contributions by the Bush administration, it's just the fact that the Supreme Court is working for the Bush administration, not for justice.
Well, how can you call it biased? I mean, you could, but it's the court. And Justice Roberts says, my position on as a matter of principle is free speech has to trump these issues in the campaign.
Yeah, the principles of a Republican.
Okay, there we go. The charge that it's partisan right there in the Supreme Court. Varun, thanks for that. Let's get another from Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The decision was that free speech sort of trumps everything. At least that's what Justice Roberts said. But my problem is that if GE or some big company can dump $2 million, then really my efforts to influence a campaign are taken away. I mean, my free speech is, you know, essentially just wiped out. And the other thing I'd just like to say is there are some former senators that Simpson and the former senator from New Hampshire who are trying to do a sort of comprehensive public funding. And I'll take my question off the air.
Yeah, we're going to talk about public funding later in this hour. But Jack Beattie, there's a couple of callers. Varun in Iowa says, we just have politics on the court now. And we've got Joe in Pennsylvania say, you know, good for their free speech, but what happens to my little megaphone when the big boys pull in?
Well, that's the question, and that's how political equality is the compelling government interest that is sacrificed here to an abstract idea of free speech. And the basic case here is the Buckley v. Valeo case of 1976, famously known as the money is speech case. In Buckley, the court allowed candidates to use their own fortunes to fund their campaigns. It allowed corporate political action committees to bundle contributions. It allowed issue ads directed at opposition candidates as long as they aren't coordinated with the candidate. And it spawned all kinds of direct mail and other means of raising money. And it opened the floodgates to soft money and the unlimited contributions. Justice White, in his dissent in that case, he said the holding is not that federal candidates have the constitutional right to purchase their election, but many will so interpret the court's conclusion in this case. And that really has been the holding there, that money, if money is speech, then GE can say whatever it wants at whatever decibel of dollar, and your voice won't be heard. And Justice Souter, in his dissent, says maybe it's time to revisit the constitutional framework set down by Buckley, which was an incoherent case in that it said the government can limit contributions, it can't limit expenditures.
Lawrence Lessig, you're a law professor. Do you see this court is going all the way back to Buckley v. Valeo and deciding that money is not speech? It looks like they're going the other way.
Yeah, I think that position is pretty solid for the next few years, at least, where few means maybe 10 or 15 years. And I think what's got to happen is political action outside of the court has got to look for a solution that's more consistent, that's consistent with the rules the court has set down. I don't think Buckley was grounded in constitutional reason that deserves respect, but I do think that the Supreme Court is going to continue to uphold it. So we've got to look for ways to really give congressmen what they want, which is an opportunity to do their job and not to have to spend all their time raising money. And you can do that indirectly by supporting very strong public financing of elections. That, of course, is going to silence GE, and, you know, we might worry about GE's, you know, power in a particular election. But to the extent it makes it possible for candidates to be running their campaigns without worrying every day about raising tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, it will have the effect we need, which is that the congressmen focus on the job of picking good policy as opposed to policy that makes them money in their elections.
Let's go to Steve, calling from Hull, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm kind of a First Amendment absolutist, and I'm glad, therefore, that the Supreme Court wanted to protect free speech.
Okay.
But I think they've got the scope of the issue all wrong. They're extending free speech much farther than I think you can constructively extend it. And this goes back decades and decades to when they decided that business corporations had all the rights of citizens. And the place I think we ought to draw the line is between corporations that get their substance and financial support as contributions from individuals who are obviously in that function banding together and assembling within the meaning of the Constitution, and the other corporations which make widgets and divert money from the widget cash stream into the political process to influence.
So, Steve, what do you mean by that? You would let the unions buy these ads then? Let's say a union, for example, or a religious group, but not a corporation. I don't know why we're picking on GE today, but not GE?
Absolutely not GE. And I think that the dichotomy between business corporations and unions is, of course, one that's rooted in history. But I don't see why we give it special recognition as a matter of political process. You could, of course, oppose union interests with groups of voluntarily assembled corporate executives who could also strive to influence the political process, or shareholders.
So a country club contribution versus a union, but not a corporate one, you say. Let's look at that. Lawrence Lessig, again, as law professor, can you see the plug being pulled on the corporations standing to claim that free speech right, as our free speech absolutist Steve would like to see?
Well, again, I think what Steve's identifying is a point way back in our history where the court could have gone a different way. The court decided that corporations are persons for purposes of the 14th Amendment's equal protection jurisprudence, and the courts have treated corporations as having the right to speak more recently. That's equivalent to the right of individual. Certain contexts in which that's not true, for example, when they're engaging in fraud or in consumer protection areas, but in general, that's been the push. And I would agree that in each of those points, the court could have gone the other way, but I don't think it's likely that we're going to see the Supreme Court shifting direction radically right now. And again, you know, I think that one of the biggest problems that progressives have had over the past 30 years is every time there's an important social issue, they turn to the courts to solve it. Like, let's race to the United States Supreme Court and get them to give us the right answer, as opposed to trying to motivate political action from the ground up. And this issue, I think, is the greatest opportunity for political action, because of all the issues that are out there, absolutely every ordinary person out there thinks politics is corrupt.
Let me turn to our callers. In Lisbon, Iowa, we've got Roger calling. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing?
We're great.
I'm concerned about the issue of free speech. The public has a right to know who's doing the speaking. And my concern is that it's very often the case that some obscure group, for example, the Swift Boat Veterans, they weren't the ones actually paying for those ads that were attacking Kerry. And here in Iowa, we have all kinds of sweet-sounding groups that come on supporting candidates. But it's typically corporations that are, in fact, hiding who it is that's speaking. The public has a right to know who's doing speaking.
So when they're hidden behind a curtain of some kind of interest group, you don't exactly know whose money is at work.
We virtually never know, and if there's going to be free speech, at a minimum, there ought to be a very transparent way of the public finding out who's doing that. I think every ad that appears should demonstrate very clearly who's paying for that ad.
It's a good point. Hard to make it is all that transparent. Maybe roll credits like a movie where everybody who's pitched in shows up there. Roger, it's a good point. We've got another caller from Iowa where they know something about campaign politics. Dennis in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air. What do you think?
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this has been a very good discussion. I think Roger's recent point is excellent. I simply want to say, as an Iowan who's been following presidential politics for 20 years, we should not, in this matter, underestimate the savvy and the tolerance of the voter. In the last 60 days of the election, very few voters are affected in a way that makes them change their mind. And my experience is that these big-time ads come on real hard, and we turn the TV off. I'll take my response.
Well, Dennis, let me just ask you, though, about what Roger raised on the Swift Boat ads, for example. Those came in. They seemed to have an impact on the Kerry campaign. Do you think voters were hoodwinked, or that means that the ads were credible, or, you know, are you so confident that an ad barrage can't knock a candidate off a path they might otherwise be on with voters?
No, I'm not completely confident. I just want to say there's a mix here.
Yeah.
And the voter has a role in this, and at least in Iowa, my experience is that voters more often than not understand the situation and vote accordingly.
Got it. Jack Beattie, there's a vote of confidence in voter savvy. Don't underestimate who's seeing these ads.
Well, he's got a very good point. I mean, Iowans, as anyone who's watched the caucus will know, are extremely well-informed about politics. I was watching a Bill Richardson event last night, and the kinds of questions he was getting from an audience, I forget where it was, would put to shame the Washington Press Corps for their sophistication and depth. So Iowa voters may be a special case. It is unfortunately the case, though, and I think studies bear this out, that given the hurried pace of modern life, people have very little time to study the issues. One study found that something like three-quarters of voters couldn't name their congressperson. And in that context, ads have, I'm afraid, a terrible influence because they are the one form of political communication that many voters see. So I do think that they have an effect. I don't think it's a one-to-one effect, but there are just too many cases out there where ads have really shaped a race. I think that Kerry race is an example, but so is poor Russ Feingold. He was trying to run a race in 2004 where he was going to observe, you know, the Bill Proxmire spending limits. Basically, he wasn't going to spend any money or very little money, and that he was basically saying to the voters, look, I have integrity. I'm not raising much money here. And he was nearly beaten by somebody who was spending a fortune.
Lawrence Lessig, what about it? The voter savvy weapon here. How strong against an onslaught of campaign spending, big money campaign spending?
Well, I agree that the voters are pretty good, especially in a place like Iowa, where it seems like your profession is picking presidential candidates. But I think that's why it's important to distinguish between the issue that the Supreme Court was deciding, which is the ability of people to just run ads that have nothing to do with a particular candidate, and the way that campaign financing affects candidates. What I would find when I would go to Capitol Hill and talk to members of Congress about the issues that I used to be working on, about intellectual property and copyright and the regulation of culture, was that the congressman didn't understand that there was really even another side to the issue. And that's because the only side they ever heard, the only issues they ever understood, were the issues that were backed up by money. So in that context, what money is doing isn't so much as blinding the congressman from doing the right thing. It's just really controlling what the congressman understands. And I think that's a really critical part that a better system of financing could begin to correct.
And when you talk about a context for these votes and for how policy gets made, the idea that Washington has become a kind of center of wealth in this country, with people moving out of Congress and into big money lobbying jobs and everything else, makes them part of that money world. Let's go to Khaled, calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Khaled, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Let me just say this. First of all, I think I'm an informed voter, not unlike the folks from Iowa. But
great.
The fact is, I'm feeling very disgusted with the whole scene. I think I'm making up a bumper sticker, welcome to the home of the free, now the home of regulation and corruption. I'd like to ask your guest, how many people on K Street represent the voter, the small taxpayer? How many represent on K Street the big money interests who want to keep 13% tax rates for hedge fund operators and so forth? I personally feel, and gentlemen, and this is a feeling that's being heard, through my course of friendships and so forth, that we have been betrayed by the system. Let me just one last comment, and I'll get off. When I was returning from Moscow in 2005, June, And when the Supreme Court came down that decision, with those little folks in London lost their home to the big money interest, that developer, I said to myself, wow, what a country. We went to Korea because the communists went south. We went to Vietnam because the communists went south. You can't go to Cuba or smoke a cigar because it's communist. But when you walk into a Walmart or whatever, it's everything's made in China. And they're a pretty good, they're a communist nation. They'll shoot you if you open your mouth. There's something wrong with this picture, and it's not being heard. I want to listen to your guests.
Khaled, thanks very much. There's a voter who's paying attention and feeling, as he says, betrayed. Let's see if there's maybe another way here. I'll go to Roosevelt, New Jersey now, and David Donnelly. He's National Campaigns Director at Public Campaign Action Fund. They're looking for publicly funded campaigns. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Have you got the way out of this, and does it have a snowball's chance of ever happening that we'd take money out of the campaign scene and just put public money in, make it publicly funded, stem to stern?
Well, I've really appreciated the comments from the listeners as well as from Professor Lessig. I mean, I think he has put his finger right on the pulse. Our elected officials are spending far too much time raising money for their reelection and far too little time addressing the issues that the nation needs them to address. We elected them to do certain jobs, and they're actually forced by the system to spend all their time looking out for their reelection. The good news is that I think many members of Congress and senators are getting a sense that this system is completely unsustainable. Senators Dick Durbin and Senator Spector, Arlen Spector of Pennsylvania, have introduced legislation called the Fair Elections Now Act in Congress, and it would provide public financing for Senate candidates who agree to limit their spending and those candidates who have qualified by raising a large number of small contributions in their home states.
But how real is that? I mean, Lawrence Lessig says, with this decision and others likely to come from the Roberts Court, we're looking at 10 or 15 years of drift in this direction at the court level. How real is the public campaign funding option, you know, on a scale, at a scope that would change the balance in Washington?
It's actually the only viable constitutional option that we see now because of this decision of dealing with the big money in politics. And we're seeing practical success at the state level in state after state. In two states, Maine and Arizona, systems like this have been on the books for several years. Candidates like it. Voters like it. In fact, in Maine, 84% of the state lawmakers are elected under the system. In Arizona, we have a system where 9 of the 11 statewide office holders were elected without raising a dime of special interest money, including the governor, who's now run twice and run under this. And it deals with the, you know, what we're seeing in this court decision is probably the beginning of an avalanche of big money in politics, both from the perspective of corporations and unions coming back into spending money on broadcast ads, but also candidates having to be forced into raising even more money to respond to them under these laws in the states and under the proposal that's been introduced in the Senate, and there's a companion bill in the House as well. Candidates would receive what we call fair fight funds from the public resources to be able to respond. So it doesn't deal with these issues of trying to limit speech. It deals with them by trying to provide more speech for candidates to be on the playing field and communicating with voters to encourage even more debate on the issues of the day.
Lawrence Lessig, how about it? Public campaign financing, do you see this as the non-court way out of money politics?
Well, I totally agree that it's the only path that has a safe constitutional pedigree right now. And so I think it's, you know, if we want to do something about this right now, this is what we should be doing. There are slight variations on this that I also think would be constitutional, but I think it's important to focus on what we can do immediately to begin to change the dynamic in Washington. And public financing is something that the court would not strike down as long as it doesn't include limits on what the people can spend outside of the public financing.
Jack, how about it? Is that the way, and do you think this country will buy it? Is the level of unease, discomfort among the politicians themselves great enough that they might finally push for it?
I'm afraid not, even though this has bipartisan backing. I mean, I see the ads already. Socialized politics?
Do you want your tax money to be paying for negative ads? It just set up for special interest override, I think. The perception that has to grow in order to trump that is the one that Professor Lessing introduced at the beginning, that campaign finance reform, getting the big money out of politics, is the threshold issue of our time. Nothing serious can be done on global warming, on health care, on taxes, really on energy, on any issue, until the grip of big money on politics is somehow broken and the voice of the people can be heard. And if people understand that, then however unpalatable it sounds, fair elections and public funding, I think, will make sense. But they have to understand it not as an abstract matter, but as, look, either you buy the politicians or the special interests buy them.
Somebody's going to buy. Let me go to Steve in Belchertown, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, as far as making things transparent, my concept is that we should have politicians wear NASCAR-type jackets so that every corporation that is, funding that politician would be clearly visible to the American people. You could even have them drive a NASCAR-type car. That way, going down the street, you would know that Joseph Biden was, maybe in the pocket of MBNA and not necessarily for the people, or that Dick Cheney was firmly Halliburton and all
that. That's terrific. Put the bumper sticker right on their sport coat.
Absolutely, and so that when people are thinking that they're voting for a Republican who's against abortion, they could see that he was also funded by a company that created a morning after pill.
Well, it would make C-SPAN a lot more colorful and maybe interesting, Steve. I love it. Thanks very much for that. Lawrence Lessig, I heard you there trying to come in after Jack's oration.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant idea. And I think, in fact, using the internet and digital technologies, we could do it for them.
Yes, we could, couldn't we? There's something for you, David Donnelly, or for Sheila Kermode's earlier.
I don't think they make jackets that big.
They'll have to wear Supreme Court-style gowns.
Yeah.
Just to pick up on Jack's latter theme, I disagree with his former point about the type of opposition we actually see in public opinion polls. There's a lot of public support for a public financing system as long as voters understand the benefits. But I do think we need a campaign to relate this issue to the kitchen table issues and the major issues of the day, so that people understand this is not a process discussion. This is a discussion about who has power in our democracy and who controls government. And until we get to that point, I agree it's going to be more difficult for us to advance this legislation. But I think we're heading in that direction. We have a broad-based coalition of organizations working on this, beyond the reform community to organizations that work on a number of the key issues of the day, from environmental issues to workers' issues, to a variety of others that have weighed in, and a coalition that represents about 60 million Americans. So we're excited about the progress that we've made. We see working examples at the state level where we have passed it at the ballot box and through legislative chambers. And the system is getting so unsustainable that former opponents of public financing are now coming on board because they see this as the only way for them to preserve their ability to do their jobs that they're elected rather than spend their time, being forced into the waiting arms of those that are creating so many other problems.
Lawrence, if I may, we just got a minute here left. Let me just ask your sort of optimism-pessimism ratio on this. Jack Beatty says, none of our big issues are going to really be solved until this is solved. You say, well, that's going to be 10 or 15 years. That sounds like a long time if the issues are that big and that pressing. Can we work this out in time to get our arms around what needs addressing?
Oh, I'm very optimistic that we can get a solution that's constitutional in the short run. And again, I do agree that this is campaign financing. I think one important thing is that people keep the numbers in perspective. You're talking about what's said to be the $1 billion presidential race.
Yeah.
But we're going to spend $20 billion this year on internet advertising. Now, I don't know what you think is more important, but if we're going to spend $20 billion on internet advertising, I don't mind spending $1 billion on picking the next president of the United States. So the actual fact is we don't spend a lot of money in total relative to other advertising campaigns on our political process. We should be willing to spend more. And I think that, you know, just like we don't have McDonald's run our elections, and even if we do have voting companies running our elections, we shouldn't have, you know, we should make this part of what government pays for. Government should pay for the process of selecting our representatives so that we have representatives who can listen to the problems and figure the right solution. That's the only way that fundamental problems will get changed.
Well, we've got the issue raised right up there for all to see, and we appreciate each of your contribution to doing that. Lawrence Lessig joining us today from Berlin, professor of law at Stanford Law School, in a new realm today of money politics. Professor Lessig, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
David Donnelly with the Public Campaign Action Fund, National Campaigns Director there. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack Beatty, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.